And I will say welcome. My name is Mary Olson. I'm in the Southeast Office of Nuclear Information and Resource Service. I'll be moderating the call tonight, and I am thrilled that we are committed to doing these type of information sessions for our grassroots on a quarterly basis, and we invite people's suggestions. Tonight, we are focused on nuclear energy and the climate crisis, and we have three terrific speakers. I'm going to go ahead and introduce all three. They will speak in the order of their introduction. And then we're reserving it, hopefully about half of this evening's program for your questions. And we actually have a technological way for you to raise your hand since there's close to 100 people who registered. We hope that that many will tune in tonight. So currently everybody is muted except for the speakers, but when we open the questions, we'll explain that. First up tonight will be Michael Marriott, who has been for more than 25 years in a leadership role with Nuclear Information and Resource Service. This past year, he graduated to president. And I also want to pitch his wonderful blog, which is called Green World. You can find it through the NIRS website, www.nirs.org, or the really cool address, safeenergy.org. So Michael will be talking to us first, followed by Hunter Lovins, who is the founder and president of Natural Capitalism Solutions, based in Colorado, but working globally. There was something written on the website that I love so much that I just want to read what it says. It says, natural capitalism is regenerative of human and natural capital while increasing prosperity and quality of life. And Hunter's going to be talking with us about the ways in which that's actually happening today through renewable energy. And then finally, Tim Judson, who has joined Nuclear Information and Resource Service in the last year as our executive director. Tim comes from a background with Citizen Awareness Network for a decade and a half, now and recently serving as their board chair, as well as being a founder of Green... Now, I got that wrong. He'll tell you better. Green Economy in New York. Alliance for a Green Economy, that's it, in New York. And Tim is going to be talking about the ways in which the nuclear industry is biting back on a positive future. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and give you to Michael.
Okay, thank you, Mary. I sort of looked through the list of people on this call today, and you know, a lot of you have been doing this kind of work for a long time, and there really isn't a lot, really isn't anything new in what I'm going to say and why nuclear power is not a solution to the climate crisis. I was looking over a piece I wrote back in 2009 that I wrote for Daily Kos, titled "Top 10 Reasons Nukes Won't Save Climate." And there's, you know, if I were writing that today, there's, you know, hardly a word I would change in it. Nothing much has changed in the last 5 years, but what's a little scarier is that it brought me back further to the a piece I wrote in 1989 for Multinational Monitor, where I wrote, and I'm going to quote myself here, "To the nuclear industry, the greenhouse effect is a godsend. The industry is counting on concern over the greenhouse effect for its resurrection." So the point is that, you know, this has been an issue for decades now, this notion that nuclear power is a climate solution. And it's sort of tidal in a way, meaning that it ebbs and flows depending on how much the nuclear industry thinks it needs that argument. And really, in a lot of ways, it's the last argument the industry has for its existence. When even its operating reactors become too expensive to compete with alternative sources, when new reactors become too expensive to build without extensive subsidies at the state and federal levels. They really don't have much argument to go on. So it's really down to climate. So we'll see if we can knock out some of those arguments real quickly here. And the first point is that if nuclear power were going to make any kind of meaningful impact on climate, you would need too many reactors. In fact, you would need more reactors than the industry is capable of building in a time frame that would be relevant. There were back about 10 years ago, there were several studies on this, not by anti-nuclear groups, but by MIT, the Commission on Energy Policy, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and they all came up with about the same numbers that if nuclear power were going to make a significant dent in reducing global carbon emissions, and by significant I mean about 20%, it would require building about 1,500 to 2,000 new reactors worldwide. In the U.S., that would mean 300 to 400 new reactors worldwide. Because remember, we have around 400 reactors operating in the world right now, but most of those are going to be retired. Their licenses are going to expire, even with license extensions, over the next 30, 40 years. So the first 400 reactors, new reactors built, would only leave us at replacement level. And to get those greater carbon reductions, you would need, particularly because nuclear power is not carbon free, and we'll get to that a little bit later, but you would need these 1,500 to 2,000 new reactors. Okay, fine. The problem is the industry isn't capable of building that many. There aren't the facilities available to build the reactor pressure vessels needed for nuclear reactors. There's Japan Steelworks, which can build about eight reactor pressure vessels per year. China apparently has a facility now. Russia may have a facility. Altogether, we're looking at a global possibility of 20, 25 reactors per year, maximum. Now, to get to this level that we were talking about, this 1,500 to 2,000, that would mean building a reactor every 2 to 3 weeks, putting up a new reactor every 2 to 3 weeks from now to mid-century. That's a lot more reactors than the industry could build. It's a lot more than they've ever built, and it's just simply not feasible. So when the industry talks about itself as a climate change solution, it's lying. What they really mean is that an individual reactor may well produce less carbon than an individual coal plant or an individual gas plant. But there is not, the nuclear industry does not have the ability to be a global or national or meaningful source of carbon reductions on the scale that is needed. Okay, another reason, too little safety. And by that I mean the reactors that are being built now worldwide, and there's a couple dozen, they are, think of it as the 2014 Ford Focus versus the 1979 Ford LTD. It's basically the same concept. They're both cars. The 2014 Focus probably has better fuel efficiency and is a little bit safer. It has airbags and stuff. It's an improvement. But you know what? We still have car accidents. And with these new nuclear plants that will be built now, the AP1000, the ESBWR, whatever ones you want to name, you know, that they're simply extensions of the pressurized and boiling water reactors that were going up in the 1960s and 1970s. They're mild improvements, but they're not inherently safe. They're not what is known as Generation 4 reactors. They don't use any kind of exotic fuel like thorium. None of those new reactors exist. They exist only on paper. And they have existed on paper in most cases for decades. Nobody's wanted to build them. So when you hear certain climate scientists who don't know a lot about nuclear power, and I'm speaking directly about Dr. James Hansen at the moment, talk about the need to build integral fast reactors or Generation 4 reactors or whatever reactor design he's pushing at the moment, the fact is they don't exist. Since they don't exist, they can't be put into operation into a time period that is relevant. Even if a utility wanted to build one, which is not the case, even if a government wanted to promote it, which it was not really the case, you know, maybe a little bit in China, but not in most places, the earliest you could get one of these going would be about 20 years. Well, Dr. Hansen himself and most climate scientists have pointed out that we need to take steps to reduce carbon a lot faster than 20 years. So his solution doesn't work. We need different solutions. Another reason, too much waste. If you're going to build that many reactors, of course, we've already ruled that out, but if you were to try to build that many reactors, well, you know what? You need radioactive waste sites. We don't have any in the world, and yet we would need a new Yucca Mountain-sized waste site about every 5 years somewhere in the world. Since we can't find even one waste site anywhere in the world, the odds that we'll come up with one every 5 years are pretty slim. Then there's the issue of carbon itself. Nuclear power is, in my view, a low-carbon electricity source, but it is not carbon-free. It does release a small amount of radioactive carbon, but the fuel chain, the nuclear fuel chain, mining, milling, processing, enrichment, and all that, fuel fabrication, waste monitoring, that leaves a carbon footprint. And exactly how large that footprint is still a matter of some debate, but Professor Benjamin Silvercool, who at the time was at Virginia Tech, has done what I still believe is the best study on the issue, and he concluded that nuclear power is about 6 times the carbon of wind and 2 to 3 times the carbon of solar, and that is based on solar prices that don't exist anymore. It's based on, you know, as solar becomes more efficient, it also becomes more of a competitor on the carbon level as well. I'm going to run through a couple more pretty quickly here. The industry likes to talk about emissions-free nuclear power. Well, the reactors don't emit much carbon, but they do emit tritium, and they do emit, at times, cesium and strontium and the whole alphabet soup of radionuclides that are toxins. We have to remember that while carbon is an extremely important pollutant, it is not the only pollutant of concern. And if we can reach our goal of reducing carbon without adding radioactive pollutants, why wouldn't we?
Michael?
Yes.
We're having feedback that some people can't hear you. And I know that your phone is a challenge, but try to hold the phone a little closer if you could.
Okay.
That's better already.
I'll try to yell a little bit, too.
Okay.
My landline is not the best, I'm afraid. I'm sorry. Another issue is that nuclear power does not work well in warming climates, and it is pretty clear at this point that our climate already is warming. What we are trying to do at this point is avoid the worst of climate change. We're not going to avoid all of climate change. And nuclear power needs cold water for cooling. It needs cold water for the condensers to generate electricity. And there have been a couple heat waves in Europe, terrible heat waves that killed thousands of people and basically shut down the French nuclear industry. That's a big problem in France, where nuclear power is nearly 80% of the power. There were basically people had no electricity for days. U.S. reactors have closed as well because of lack of cooling water, because the water temperatures had reached too high. And the most startling one of those was last summer at the Millstone reactors in Connecticut, which on Long Island Sound, having been swimming in Long Island Sound myself, I can tell you that the water doesn't really get very warm there, even in midsummer, but it was too hot for the Millstone reactors for a few days. They had to close. As the climate warms, this is going to become a more common occurrence, and nuclear power will become a less reliable electricity source. And, of course, we also have the problem although Millstone was an exception, those are factors for reactors located inland on rivers or lakes. The problem for reactors located on coastal levels, especially on low-lying areas, is that instead of using water, climate change, as it accelerates and sea level rises, they may find themselves underwater. And now let me get just to the two big issues. Renewables and efficiency are faster, cheaper, cleaner, and safer than nuclear power. And I know Hunter is going to be talking more about this, so I'm going to be very brief on this end, although I've written about this much more extensively. But, if we can reach our carbon goals faster, cheaper, cleaner, and safer, why wouldn't we? And just to give you an idea of how much cheaper we're talking about, there was a chart. This is a different paper from Dr. Servacool and some others that he put out last year comparing the cost of different electricity sources, basically a carbon cost ratio. And this is a number that refers to the mean life cycle carbon emissions multiplied by the mean levelized cost. And so just use the numbers for comparison. Wind, the number is 31. Concentrated solar, the number is 146. Geothermal, the number is 247. Solar PV, photovoltaic, is 1521, although I'll get back to that in a moment. And nuclear is 2,976, or almost 100 times higher than wind. And that's in terms of cost effectiveness of reducing carbon emissions. In fact, the only thing more expensive than nuclear is clean coal with carbon capture and storage, which, of course, is a technology that doesn't actually exist yet. The solar PV, by the way, which this paper has at about half the carbon cost ratio of nuclear power, is based on costs for installation of solar PV that already have dropped by about half from the number given in this chart, which is $4,700 to $7,000 per installed kilowatt. Well, rooftop solar in this country is now running about half of that, so the carbon cost ratio number would actually probably be in the 700 to 800 range. On the other hand, the nuclear costs were based on the mean of cost of $3,600 per kilowatt to $8,000 per kilowatt. We haven't had a nuclear plant come in at $3,600 per kilowatt in 30, 40 years. We're not going to have any come in anywhere close to that. You know, certainly not the Vogtle and Summer reactors or any that might dare to try to follow those. So the nuclear number would actually be higher than stated there. And that gets really to the biggest problem, is that nuclear power is too expensive to be a viable carbon reduction source. And in fact, because it is so expensive, it is counterproductive. Because if you have, you know, limited dollars to spend, you want to put them to those sources that are going to give you the most bang for the buck. And if we spend money on nuclear power, we are not getting the bang for the buck that we should be getting. Energy efficiency program, and I haven't mentioned that yet, so energy efficiency is probably seven times more effective at reducing carbon emissions than is nuclear. Renewables are, you know, two, three, four times more efficient. You know, spending money on nuclear power, you might as well spend it on coal. It's just as counterproductive as spending it on nuclear power. So those are some of the basic reasons. Those are your talking points, and now you're going to find out, you know, what the real solutions are.
Thank you, Michael. And you recently updated that fact sheet. Is it on our Nukes and Climate page?
Yeah, the fact sheet is, and the Daily Kos article is on Daily Kos.
Cool. Thank you so much.
And the Benjamin Silvercool studies I mentioned are also both on our website in the climate section.
Great. Those are links on the left side of the page when you go to www.nirs.org. So now, Hunter, you're next up, and give us some good news.
Well, the good news, of course, is that efficiency and renewables are sweeping the market. Everything Michael has said is correct. And like Michael, I've been at this for rather a long time. My first book on the problems with nuclear power came out in 1980, called Energy War: Breaking the Nuclear Link. And we were concerned there particularly about the fact that if you try to carpet the earth with nuclear power plants, which was fashionable then because we were concerned about how are we going to replace oil. It's in some circles fashionable now as an excuse that perhaps we can deal with the climate crisis that way. The fundamental problems remain. You, as Michael said, you've got rate and magnitude challenges. You can't build enough of the darn things fast enough, and you certainly cannot build them cheaply enough to be any kind of a competitive answer, either to we're running out of oil or we have a climate crisis. If you try to do it, assuming that you wish to put essentially all of an economy's discretionary investment money into building nuclear plants, which is frankly what it would take to build enough of them, again, even assuming that you could build enough pressure vessels fast enough to do that, you would spread around the planet the ability to build nuclear weapons programs in any country or subnational group that so desired. And indeed, most of the recent entrance into the nuclear weapons club have come from countries that use the excuse of, oh, we're just building these nuclear plants for our domestic power. You can't stop us doing that. Well, we need to try to stop it, because the more you spread around the ability to have domestic nuclear power, the more you spread around the ability to build bombs. Obviously, manifestly, with the news going on today out of Iraq and all over the Middle East, this is a very bad idea. The good news, though, is we don't need to. Recent report out from Citigroup, hardly the place that you would expect to be trumpeting the success of renewable energy just for its own sake. And what they said is 10-year forward projection of gas, somewhere around 11 cents a kilowatt hour. 10-year forward projection of solar, around 10 cents a kilowatt hour. They said it's over. Solar's going to win. They admitted that there is now utility scale solar on offer at 4 cents a kilowatt hour, and 3 or 4 instances of it on offer at 5 cents a kilowatt hour. But they said, well, that's we're not going to count that because that's driven by the tax credits. Note to self, all energy investment is driven by subsidies. And the International Energy Agency, our own Energy Information Administration, essentially everybody who has looked at this issue admits that the subsidies to conventional forms of energy are at least 10 times the subsidies even now being given to all forms of efficiency and renewables. And historically, of course, it's been massively in favor of nuclear and fossil options. So I'm a free marketeer. I would prefer no subsidies at all. I also believe in the tooth fairy that obviously is never going to happen. But having Citigroup say, subsidies aside, solar wins at 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Mark Cooper's numbers out of Vermont, Craig Severance's numbers, both showed new nukes come on at somewhere around 24 cents a kilowatt hour. So solar is half the price of nuclear, even on very conservative assumptions. It's over. We're going to have a renewable future. Now, if you throw enough money at it, you could get a nuclear future. You put enough engines on it, you can get a bathtub airborne, but this is not the way to build a sensible airplane. It's certainly not the way to build a sensible energy policy. So let's look at what's working around the world from little examples like the Island of Egg off Scotland, where a group of people got together, crowdsourced funding, bought the island, and are taking it 100% renewably powered. Or Samsø Island off Denmark, where the people have already taken it 100% renewably powered. Or Scotland, which reckons to be 100% renewably powered as early as 2020. Towns across Germany that are already 100% renewably powered. Germany itself, which reckons to be 100% renewable by 2050, as they shut down the nuclear plants. Europe, Siemens, the big industrial conglomerate, reckons that their industrial future is a pan-European smart grid, big wind off the North German and Danish coast, wave off Scotland, wave off Portugal, solar across the south, biofuels, distributed generation everywhere, all hooked into a smart grid connecting smart houses and smart cars. The batteries in the cars become the backup for the entire system. And batteries in cars now running around on the world are at least 10 times the backup that a grid would need. And Ed Kahn at Lawrence Berkeley showed years ago that if you have a regional grid that has any two of the three of solar, wind, and hydro, it is statistically more reliable than a grid based on big baseload coal and nuclear plants. Because when one of those things goes down, you have to have a huge chunk of electricity standing by, called spinning reserve, which you and I pay for. So when you build a nuclear plant, you not only have to pay to build the plant, you have to pay to build the reserve for when the plant goes down, because even ordinary operation and maintenance would have the plant shut down from time to time. And this, of course, is assuming that it doesn't go into a catastrophic failure, as we're now still witnessing at Fukushima. Wind spills, that's a bad one. Sun spills, that's called a nice day. So our choice here is we have the technology we need to deliver all the energy that we want to run a modern industrial society. Cheaper, as Michael said, faster, more reliably, with much less danger than reverting to a technology which was promised to be too cheap to meter, that became, as the economist said, too expensive to matter. It's also worth considering that we are living in an ever more dangerous world. Back in 1981, we wrote a book called Brittle Power, which you can get off the Natural Capitalism website for free. That's www.natcapsolutions.org. Brittle Power was written for the Pentagon. It was an exploration of the vulnerability of the domestic energy sector. And what we found scared us so badly, we put the book for formal government classification review to be sure we were not writing a cookbook for terrorists on how to turn the system off. And if you think that we're pretty safe, consider what happened at the Metcalf substation out in California about a year and a half ago, when some people who obviously knew quite what they were doing took down the substation. They cut the external communications, shot out the insulators, and took down the station. About 3-4 months ago, there was a front page article in the Wall Street Journal by John Wellinghoff, who had recently resigned as the chairman of the Federal Energy Commission, saying this was a dress rehearsal. These guys knew what they were doing, and they're looking to take down the grid. And in Brittle Power and in subsequent reports, we found that it's frighteningly possible to take down the national electric grid. At that point, unless you are extraordinarily lucky, you have nuclear plants that have a tendency to want to melt, as we've witnessed at Fukushima. On the other hand, last September, when we had global warming caused floods here in Colorado, the solar system on my ranch worked just fine. I have battery backup, I have isolation relays, so if the grid goes down, I keep running. And imagine instead a society in which communities are self-reliant in energy. When you do this, you generate jobs. 10 times the number of jobs by investing in renewables that you get from investing in fossil or, God save us, nuclear, which is, as Cooper and Severance showed, the most expensive option, at least well over 20 cents a kilowatt hour. So we can also solve our economic crisis by investing in energy efficiency and renewables. Per megawatt saved in a community, you generate over $2 million in increased economic activity, over $500,000 in increased wages. The solar industry, the wind industry, is much better for jobs. They are higher paying jobs. They tend to be manufacturing jobs. About a quarter of the jobs in renewables are manufacturing, compared to about 9% for the economy as a whole. So do we want to bring manufacturing back to the United States? We know how to do it. And this is what Germany has been doing. The state of Bavaria, just this one state in Germany, has installed more solar capacity than the entire United States. Have we forgotten how to be America? The town of Wilspolsried produces 321% more energy than it uses, so they sell the excess, making themselves $5.7 million every year. And renewables are spreading very, very rapidly. Japan added 9.5 gigawatts of solar in 2013. A gigawatt is roughly a nuclear-sized chunk of electricity. They built the equivalent of 9 nukes in a year. China installed 14 gigawatts of solar in 2013 and projects to well more than double that this year. They have 100 gigawatts of wind, and China has committed to become a renewable country. The nuclear advocates say, oh, look at China, they're building nuclear plants. China can do math. They realize that efficiency in renewables is a much better future for them. And I was in China a few months ago, and everywhere I went, the conversation was around, how do we do more renewables? This is what we want to clean the air. This is what we want to create jobs. So I think you're going to see over the next few years, China has already put in place a carbon market. They are investing hugely in efficiency and renewables. And China will outcompete us by being smarter than us. We're really the only country in the world anymore that still thinks that we're going to pretend to deal with the climate crisis by building nukes. Michael made the point, every dollar you invest in the most expensive technology is a dollar you cannot invest in the technologies that displace dramatically more carbon. And my friend Jigar Shah has a marvelous book called Creating Climate Wealth, in which he walks through how we do it, using efficiency, using renewables. He said, due to continuous technological improvement, half of all greenhouse gas emissions will always be profitable to eliminate through efficiency and through renewables. So we can continue driving down our emissions. We can solve the climate crisis at a profit. And this was the thesis of one of my latest books, The Way Out, Kickstarting Capitalism to Save Our Economic Ass, in which I walk through how do we make electricity? How do we move people around? How do we conduct agriculture? How do we run industry using world best practice in energy efficiency, in renewables, in low carbon approaches? And we can do it. If you don't believe me, check out the work of Dr. Mark Jacobson, Stanford professor, who teamed up with Mark Ruffalo, with Josh Fox, with a number of people to put forth the Solutions Project. And what they've done is gone state by state by state in the United States and for the country as a whole, and Mark had the cover of Scientific American a few years back, showing for the world as a whole, by about 2030, 2035, we can be 100% renewably powered. And then walking through the economics of why doing this is the best way to drive economic prosperity, to create genuine security in our communities and across our country, and to leave our children a finer future. What's not to like?
Thank you so much, Hunter. I think you've given us very good bolstering for the not-so-good news that Tim's going to share. And then we will turn to our participants for questions. I just want to add that I grew up in Indiana, and when I go home now, I'm so thrilled to see the numbers of large wind turbines that are sprouting up in the cornfields. So it is happening. If not fast enough, it is happening. Tim, tell us.
All right.
What are
well,
they up to?
And thanks, Hunter, and thanks, Michael, for being the bearers of good tidings. What we have before us is that the climate solutions for a carbon-free, nuclear-free future are before us and are actually the best solutions that are available, and that the future of nuclear is really one of decline. And that's, because if we can't build any new reactors because it simply makes no economic sense to do so, then the existing reactors that we have really, have a shelf life in terms of how long they can last and how long they can continue generating power. But unfortunately, as the new executive director of NIRS, I also have the ignominious distinction of having to be the bearer of bad tidings, which is essentially that the nuclear industry has seen the same change coming forward. And they have just launched in the last few months a major national campaign essentially to change U.S. energy policy to favor nuclear power basically over all other energy sources. And so what I'm going to do is sort of, you know, talk about, you know, sort of what they're doing, what they're pushing for, and what we're going to be doing to try to stop them. And this is something where we're really going to need to be organizing across the country and mobilizing people in the next year or two to make sure that the major pieces of this agenda that the industry is pushing don't move forward. And I think to Hunter's point about, you know, the fact that even though nuclear, you know, isn't economical, if you throw enough money at it, you know, it can still happen. And in fact, that's essentially what the industry wants to do, is to continue propping up its old reactors through various types of subsidies and energy policy changes to eke out enough time to hopefully be able to make another go at building new reactors and continuing itself. So, you know, with that, I'll sort of go into it a little bit. So essentially, the industry has begun an aggressive push to change energy policy in the U.S. This is being led by the country's largest nuclear power companies, primarily Exelon and Entergy, which together run about more than a third of the U.S. nuclear power fleet. And this campaign represents what would be the single largest change in energy policy in about 20 years. Their intent is to make nuclear the preferred energy choice, but the changes that they're after necessarily go far beyond that. They would also support coal and natural gas-fired electricity generation, and they would block the growth of renewable energy and attempts to address climate change that are already underway and starting to pick up steam. That's, in fact, why the industry is undertaking this now, because they're at the moment where it's becoming clear that the advance of renewables and energy efficiency is already starting to have an impact on electricity rates that is putting some nuclear power plants in the country at risk of closure. And so Exelon and Entergy and the other major corporations in the industry really see sustainable energy solutions as a long-term threat to their profits. This isn't because of excessive regulations or even safety requirements on nuclear power. The industry hasn't had to implement a single safety upgrade due to the Fukushima meltdowns, and it faces less regulatory enforcement than it did 20 years ago. What's prompting this now is the closure of five reactors that were announced last year in 2013. And a number of those were due to economic conditions that didn't favor the continued operation of nuclear power plants. In short, the cost of electricity on the open market was lower than the cost of operating these plants going forward, and the companies that own them simply made the decision to close down what was essentially an unprofitable, distressed asset. So how is this happening? Well, There's a number of economic conditions that have come to confront the industry, that have really exposed the bad economic fundamentals of nuclear power. And this is aside from even the bad economics of building new nuclear reactors, because all of the current nuclear fleet are reactors whose construction debts have already been paid off. So this is really about just the basic cost of operating nuclear power plants is becoming uneconomical. You know, beginning a few years ago, there was a long-term downturn in the market price of electricity, initially due to natural gas, but also now increasingly due to the advance of energy efficiency and the increasing role that affordable renewable energy sources like wind are playing. The operating costs for operating nuclear power plants are going up. These reactors are all getting old. The average age of nuclear power plants in the U.S. is over 35 years. And just recently, the industry's lobby group reported that the average cost of operating a reactor in the U.S. Topped $44 per megawatt hour, which is more than 4.4 cents a kilowatt hour. The most uneconomical plants are even higher than that. These oldest and smallest reactors are over $50 a megawatt hour, and there's many regions across the country where the cost of electricity is just less than that. And then, you know, at the same time, the Fukushima accident has exposed the inherent safety problems, and so the NRC is eventually going to have to do something, and in doing anything to improve safety regulations is going to increase the cost of operating reactors. So they're facing a really dire economic picture going forward, and this is what they're trying to reverse. So the truth is, you know, if we're going to accomplish the transition to a sustainable energy future that, that Hunter sort of mapped out, you know, nuclear power is going to need to go by the wayside. And the interesting fact of what's happening right now is that the economics are doing what our actual policy and regulations are not, which is helping to begin the phase out of nuclear power to make room within the grid for the renewable energy sources that we need to implement. So the industry is really trying to shift the entire focus of our energy markets, our energy policy, in a way that favors nuclear. They want to restructure things to support restructure the market, even to support the most marginal, economically marginal nuclear power plants. Now, so far they've been mostly vague about the specifics of what they're after, although this is starting to become more clear as things go on. But what they're relying on in order to drive this push to policy change is manufacturing a perceived crisis of electricity reliability, of job losses when nuclear plants close, of not being able to meet our carbon reduction goals. They want to manufacture a perceived crisis in order to make bad policies palatable to people who ordinarily wouldn't want to give the industry the kind of benefits that they're asking for. This problem is so big that there isn't one solution that's going to be enough to fix the industry situation. And so they're working for multiple things at multiple levels, at the state and the federal level, from different agencies in different areas of law. But the overall goals are this. What they need to do is they need to block renewable energy and energy efficiency, which are their lowest cost competitors for moving forward. They want to create new subsidies for their old reactors, and they want to lock in essentially the kind of inflexible baseload generation that nuclear entails. They want to lock that into our grid structure, which also will benefit coal as well as nuclear. And so there's a real way in which they are trying to tie nuclear and coal together to help them save one another through changing market rules and creating these new subsidy schemes so that nuclear and coal end up subsidizing one another in a way. So what are they doing to undercut renewables? Well, first thing is, of course, they're trying to end the subsidy, the major subsidy programs that that have made renewable energy feasible. So they're, Exelon is the number one opponent of the wind production tax credit. They were actually kicked out of the American Wind Energy Association 2 years ago because of how vociferously and publicly they're trying to kill subsidies for wind power. They're also running into trouble in trying to pass an extension of the energy efficiency tax credit, and solar tax credits are coming up soon. These are all targets for the industry's campaign. The industry wants to create essentially market barriers to the advance of renewable energy. They're supporting efforts to end or restrict net metering for solar at the state level. They're supporting proposals around trying to tax the installation of solar panels on houses and buildings. And one of the more pernicious ones that they're trying to push is essentially to dilute or degrade renewable energy standards, essentially by changing them into what they're going to call clean energy standards, where nuclear becomes subsidized or subject to incentives the same way that wind and solar are now, but just simply due to the logic that nuclear isn't a big carbon emitter. And they also want to restore essentially growth to demand for electricity. Efficiency has been advancing enough so far the last several years that essentially growth in electricity demand that was expected to have been, I think more than 10% over the last few years has now slowed to almost nothing and may have gone negative in some areas of the country. The industry wants electricity demand growth to resume so that there's a growing market for electricity and they can benefit from the kind of price spikes that happened when there's electricity shortages. They also want to reorganize energy markets across the country to essentially support this baseload power that nuclear generates. Baseload is really just another way of saying inflexible. Plants that need to run basically 100% power 24/7, 365 days a year in order to operate economically efficiently. And that is exactly the kind of power plant that the nuclear relies upon, but also coal as well. So the ways that they're going to do this essentially is to rig market rules to basically target eligibility for certain revenues to baseload generators. They want to set minimum price floors for certain types of generation, including nuclear. They want to, essentially right now, because, wind especially, can when it's generating power, can bid into a market at zero because it doesn't cost anything to run a windmill. They're able to undersell nuclear in the markets regularly. And the nuclear plants basically want to have preferences built in to where baseload plants, because they're running 24/7, get to go first in the markets, and that they're guaranteed a set price in order to make sure that they're profitable. They're also exploring other things through the state level, such things as above market contracts, to get states and utilities to have to buy nuclear power. They want to tap into existing clean energy revenues, such as carbon trading or cap and trade programs. Or what's often called system benefits charges, which are direct ratepayer subsidies to support certain types of energy generation or energy resources. And they may try to implement new kinds of direct ratepayer subsidies. So how are they going about this? The industry is really mounting a multi-level PR campaign. They've been running op-eds in state and national newspapers and websites. They've actually been hiring a lot of former government officials as spokespeople. They're using front groups and AstroTurf organizations to basically push their message out so that it doesn't look like the message that we need nuclear to fight climate change is coming out of the nuclear industry. And they're drumming up a sense of crisis. And here are some messages that you should be looking out for as it's coming out in the media in different parts of the country. First of all, they want to talk about how, and this is the main term that they're using, is characterizing nuclear as carbon-free baseload. And what they're trying to drive is a sense that, nuclear is, and they'll use this statistic, is more than 60% of our carbon-free electricity. This is basically a giant fig leaf to greenwash their whole agenda and to help divide environmentalists who are, on the one hand fighting things like fracking and coal versus those of us who are fighting nuclear. They also want to drum up fears of job losses. They talk about nuclear plants as vital national assets and economic engines, to scare local communities and to drive the political process at the state level. One of the more dramatic things that's just happening right now, and this gives you a good sense of really, how the industry is working this. They've actually gotten the EPA to include a lot of benefits for nuclear in the new carbon reduction plan that the EPA released a couple weeks ago. This is, in a certain sense, the first salvo in the industry's campaign at the national level. And what the things that are in the EPA rule include benefits for both new and existing reactors. One of the things that they do is what the EPA does is basically counts existing nuclear capacity towards the state's toward preserving nuclear capacity towards the state's carbon reduction targets, essentially. So that if a nuclear plant closes, EPA assumes that that's going to result in an increase in carbon emissions, rather than saying that when a nuclear plant closes, it should be replaced by carbon-free sources. So the EPA proposes subsidies for nuclear. They have an estimate that 6% of the existing generation fleet is at risk of closure because of the bad economics. The EPA basically authorizes states to credit nuclear for carbon-free emissions at a rate of $6 a megawatt hour. And to give you a sense of what that means, just on the face of what EPA is proposing, that would be a charge to ratepayers of $250 million a year towards saving this marginal amount of the nuclear fleet. But the thing is that the EPA rule is actually very flexible, and it gives states a broad latitude to develop their plans for how they're going to meet these goals. And so it opens the door, in fact, for states like Illinois and South Carolina, where nuclear is 50% or more of their electricity supply, to do a lot more than just provide subsidies to 6% of nuclear. And so this means that, for instance, if states like Illinois were to allow nuclear a credit for being carbon-free, it could mean subsidies on the level of $47 million a year for a typical 1,000-megawatt reactor. And if states across the country were to really do this, it could add up to some, you know, on the order of something like $4.6 billion a year, for the ratepayers would pay to preserve nuclear plants that are essentially becoming uneconomical. Now, we've been seeing this also playing out at the state level, and without going into everything that's happening, I think it's instructive to look at what's happened in Illinois this year. So Exelon, which operates 11 reactors in Illinois, like I said, 50% of the state's electricity supply, opened the legislative session in January by threatening to close three of its plants, basically saying that wind power in southern and in western Illinois was threatening the viability of nuclear plants and was going to cause lots of job losses. The Chicago Tribune actually took a look at it and found that, yes, actually, you know, all 11 of Exelon's reactors have been unprofitable for some time, which supported Exelon's case that it may need to close some reactors. But without, you know, of course, looking at the fact that, 50% of the state's electricity supply is coming from nuclear, maybe Illinois could stand to do with a little less nuclear as part of its energy mix for some fuel diversity. But through this threat of closing nuclear plants, Exelon was able to drum up a lot of political support for its agenda. And the first thing that it did was Exelon was able to get the legislature to vote down or to kill a strong renewable energy bill that environmentalists in the state have been working on for a couple of years. But what they did at the end of the legislative session was even more concerning, given the national profile of what's happening, which is they managed to get the Speaker of the Illinois House of Representatives to jam through a resolution essentially promoting Exelon's whole agenda nationwide. And that's been very concerning. To get a sense of what that means, and it actually is very helpful for understanding what the industry's after, the resolution that was passed actually makes it explicit that what nuclear wants is to tether itself to coal and natural gas through these kind of, you know, emissions regulations and carbon trading schemes. And this is what the resolution says. We urge the United States Environmental Protection Agency to immediately adopt rules that treat low-carbon resources like nuclear power plants equally, regardless of age or fuel source, that they provide flexibility to the state and require actions to secure the continued operations at Illinois' nuclear plants as a compliance mechanism to meet any new federal greenhouse gas regulations, and further, to adopt rules that allow the state to offset and balance emissions from fossil fuel electric generation with emissions-free nuclear generation. Essentially, what the industry is after in the big picture is to use the facade of carbon reduction regulations and some ineffective climate policies to create a scheme where nuclear plants can sell emissions credits to coal and natural gas and essentially throw them a lifeline while boosting itself economically and enabling its old reactors to stay alive. This is exactly the future that we're trying to prevent. And, so there's going to be a lot of things that NERSC is going to be doing in this year. We're going to be working with grassroots groups and other national groups as well. But to give a sense of some of the things that are on the agenda, we've begun this petition against including nuclear in the EPA's carbon plan. We need as many people to sign as possible. We're going to be doing a major national petition drive around that, as well as trying to get, like I said, public comments, against the inclusion of nuclear in the rule. We're going to be supporting fights in the states. We're going to be alerting the grassroots groups as things are happening, providing them information and resources, also helping with mobilization. And we've been doing that as well in Illinois, supporting a petition that the groups in Illinois have been doing to oppose Exelon's agenda. We're also going to be, helping turn out people for the People's Climate March in New York City in September. That's going to be a massive international mobilization, and we want to be there to support it and also to make sure that that we have a message about keeping climate action plans nuclear free, since we know we can't get to carbon free without also becoming nuclear free. And then there are some other interesting things that are happening and things that people should be looking for in their own states. For instance, one of the more interesting things that's happening right now is that Exelon is trying to merge with a utility in the Washington D.C. area. And we're going to be building a coalition, working with folks in Maryland and D.C. around opposing that merger as a way to make Exelon choose what kind of utility company it's going to be. Is Exelon going to become an even larger utility company by opposing renewable energy and our sustainable energy future? Or are they going to have to accept a new set of rules in order to gain the kind of benefits that they're asking for from states to approve deals like this? So with that, I think we can probably move into question and answer and open up the discussion.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you, Hunter and Michael, and they're going to stay on. We have this wonderful conference deal where I'm sitting here looking at all the different phone numbers, and if you have a question, you can press *6 on your handset of your phone, and then it tells you to, I think it says press 1 or it might say *1, but you'll hear it. A little voice will tell you. And this will put you into what's known as a queue. And I will then go down the queue one by one and unmute people, and you'll get to actually ask your question live, and we'll have our speakers respond. So anybody have a question? Press *6 and then listen. I think it's just 1 after that, and it will go in the queue. Maybe we have a problem. Let me try. I can't believe there's no questions. So let me try.
I have a question.
Sorry?
Oh, yeah, so do I.
Hello?
Okay, so the *6 is unmuting. Is that what's happening?
That's
yeah.
Right.
I guess so.
That appears to be what's happening.
Okay. Well, then we'll just behave ourselves nicely, and I'll just go ahead and ask someone to talk because I'm sorry we tried this. We thought we understood it, but we'll be fine. And
This is Tony Litwinko in Los Angeles.
Good. Go ahead.
You'll forgive the quality of my voice. I have a cold. I'm a former insurance man, and I realize that if it were not for the national insurance subsidy that the nuclear industry enjoys, that the market would, in fact, very quickly shut down the whole nuclear industry. I'm wondering why no one ever contemplates attacking that program as being too expensive and putting too much at risk, and perhaps using that as a way of weakening the primary subsidy for the nuclear power industry. I'll unmute now and listen. I'll unmute and listen to your question.
Okay, Michael, you want to start on that?
Sure, I'll start and by recollecting a little bit. In my early days at NEARS, and we're talking about this is 1987 and 1988, there was, in fact, a huge campaign called the Price-Anderson Campaign. The insurance thing you referred to is called the Price-Anderson Act, so it was a major funded campaign. It was a coalition of organizations. It had full-time staff, and its only purpose was to try to repeal the Price-Anderson Act. And a vote finally came in the House, and we lost by about 100 votes. And ever since then, it used to be that the Price-Anderson Act was up for renewal every 10 years. Congress keeps extending it, so it's only up for renewal very rarely. In the current Congress, I just see little opportunity to actually get legislation of any kind on any issue through at this point. But it would be a long process to try to take on Price-Anderson again. It would have to be funded pretty heavily. I love the idea. I'd love to take it on, but it's a really difficult thing to do.
Well, okay. This is Tim. I think the point that subsidies like Price-Anderson are really what we kind of think of as like an existential subsidy, right? Without it, the industry wouldn't exist, and it's kind of hard to put a price on, you know, on that. You know, never mind, you know, what the actual value of that insurance policy is. But you know, to Michael's point about the difficulty in actually repealing Price-Anderson is correct. But I think, you know, the industry, one of the ways the industry is pitching this campaign right now to preserve itself is by portraying renewable energy sources and energy efficiency as though they're benefiting from all of these subsidies that just make it unfair to nuclear, you know, in a competitive marketplace. And, you know, we need to really remind people and, you know, make it a public part of the discussion that, you know, nuclear is getting massively subsidized through a variety of mechanisms. And there, we actually have a bill that's been introduced in Congress, in the Senate, by Senators Markey and Sanders that actually calls attention to this, essentially by, you know, making an amendment to the Price-Anderson Act to force the industry to obtain insurance to basically match, you know, or take it off of the taxpayers' back to insure the industry. And, you know, I think we need to build support for things like that to really, you know, drive the message that the benefits that nuclear is asking for are really absurd given all the benefits that it already receives.
Okay, we're in a do-over moment. I pressed the right button. Now if you do *6, it will tell you how to raise your hand, and we'll take people one at a time, and you'll still get to ask your question live. So anybody with a question, go ahead and do *6, and I am opening a line for someone called Anonymous. You're on. I can't
Hello?
See your name. Yeah, go ahead and speak your question.
This is Nancy Morris in Seattle, Washington.
Hi, Nancy.
I have a question in regards to clarification of terms such as smart houses and smart grid and this sort of thing. There's a lot of controversy in terms of the smart grid relative to smart meter rollouts that are occurring not only in this country but in Europe, but primarily now in this country because it's they're really moving rapidly ahead. And a number of people are very concerned about the implications. So as a advocate as myself, I cannot support a smart grid that's based on a wireless smart meter. And also because there's too much information out there to show that they may potentially be very hazardous to our health on the long term. I'm not talking about within a matter of a month or two, although the World Health Organization recognizes electromagnetic or EMF as a health issue and that about 3% conservatively are affected by it. And,
thank you, Nancy. I'm going to cut in because I think you've got your question on the table, or is there another
okay.
piece? Because we want to get to a lot of people.
Clarifying this issue because you're going to lose a lot of effective activists unless we start getting behind a safe and an intelligent smart grid. All right, thank you.
And Hunter, do you want to start with this?
Sure. There are indeed concerns that have been raised about the health physics of the various smart grid devices, and I would wholly support looking into these, doing the controlled tests, ensuring that these things are smart. That said, most of the people raising the concerns are perfectly happy to have Wi-Fi routers, mobile phones, and a variety of other devices around them that have at least as great concerns. And this is another one of these issues that is being trumped up, I think, as a way of scaring people. I'm much more concerned about what are called stupid smart grids. This happened in Boulder, Colorado, where the utility was trying to keep the people of Boulder captive as customers of Xcel Energy, and they promised that if the citizens of Boulder agreed to renew the franchise, they would install smart grid technology. As soon as that decision was reached, the utility pretty much let go any of their staff who knew anything about smart grid, had a bunch of people in that were not particularly skilled at it, rolled out in the middle aughts a technology that had best been developed in the mid-90s, and built a very stupid smart grid, which didn't work very well. There's a right way and a wrong way to do essentially everything. I'm never going to defend anybody's bad engineering. And if people have legitimate health concerns, they ought to be putting them forward, and we ought to be checking this out. However, personally, I would have no health concern about having a smart meter in my house, having the ability to hook my car up to it so that at any point at which my solar system is charging, my car can be selling power back to the utility and happily continue to live in that house.
Thank you. I'm going to move ahead to Bruce, who's just been unmuted. Ask your question. Do I have someone named Bruce on the line?
Oh, yes. Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Go ahead with your question.
This sort of goes on the back of the Price-Anderson question. The Nuclear Industry Insurance Indemnification Act has equivalents in the rest of the planet. There is no insurance actuary that is going to come up with a way of insuring the industry so it shut down. It would have to, as has sort of been said. We still need the technical people to deal with the waste and all of that until we have a solution. But perhaps the core thing to the economic question is how do we save the public in plain language, not in dumbed-down language, that this is not an industry that operates in the marketplace, that it in fact is just one of several industries, as is profoundly the fossil fuels industry, that engages in taxation without subsidy, without representation. We have to pay them. They control public agencies across the board. This is not what the system is. So how do we set up a clean approach of economics so that people understand exactly what we're dealing with and have that we have the ability to switch over very rapidly to better conditions?
Thank you, Bruce. I'm going to give Tim the start on that.
Sure. Well, I think, Bruce, to your question, I think it's really hard to set up, like a completely clean or neutral marketplace for energy. I think what we need to do, is really to, align economics, with policy, outcomes that we want to end up with. So right now, like I said in my presentation, we have really bad policy, or lack of policy to really drive us forward in the right direction. And absent that, economics of renewable energy and energy efficiency, have actually been really helpful in starting to move us down the right path. But this is going to be as Hunter mentioned, 20 to 30 year, maybe even 40 year transition that needs to take place. This is a massive undertaking, and it's going to need to transcend, different presidencies, state governments. Over a long period of time, and so we're really going to need to put in place, the right policies, to drive the outcomes that we want. And I guess that's just where I see it. And I know, Hunter, you mentioned that you're in favor of sort of a free market approach. And I think you're sort of winning the day with the way that the economics of the markets have been trending. But I sort of think that we need a meshing of policy and in economics in order to achieve the things that we want to see happen.
Hunter, do you want to chime in?
I am philosophically in favor of free markets. We don't have one. And then the question becomes, given how heavily we're subsidizing nuclear and the fossil industry, can we afford to do it twice and subsidize solar and efficiency, all of renewables, at least as fairly so that you have a level playing field. And again, I'd prefer to just drop all the subsidies. Jigar Shah would as well. Jigar's founder of Sun Edison and then went on to help run Richard Branson's Carbon War Room. But neither Jigar nor I are going to get what it is that we would like to see. So then it's a question of, if we are pouring taxpayer dollars into something, why don't we pick the something that gives us the most bang for the buck, the most jobs, the most security in our community, the most reliable system? And then it becomes, hands down, it's efficiency first, it's the various forms of renewables second, it's nuclear last. Really, the only interesting question is, do we and how do we use gas as a transition? But nuclear is simply off the table if you care at all about economics, if you care at all about security, if you care at all about job creation. It gives you the least desirable option of all of those.
Okay, I'm going to move us forward because the queue is growing. Going to Priscilla. Hello, Priscilla? You're unmuted. Okay, we'll come back. Are you there, Priscilla? All right, going to Mircea.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, this is Brent.
You're unmuted. Go right ahead.
Awesome, thanks. So I just like to ask, talking for a second about things that are being done in Europe with switching to more renewables and a lot of the great progress that's been made there. I guess one concerning thing that I've seen from Germany as an example of this is that that as they've been working to phase out nuclear in Germany, there's also been sort of a rise in coal at the same time. And I think there were 6 new coal plants open last year, I read. So I guess what I'd like to ask for that is that while definitely based on a lot of what I've learned in this call, we don't want to have nuclear be a big part of our future. I guess I wonder, does actively attacking that industry now sort of allow coal to hang on and even grow in some ways, and how can we avoid that?
Michael, do you want to start on this?
Sure. I'll start, and I'll actually be writing something about this probably next week on Green World about what's happening in Germany. Germany's actually cut carbon emissions since they made the decision post-Fukushima to accelerate their nuclear shutdown and begin closing the reactors. And, you know, about a third of German reactors already have closed, and the rest will close within the next 5-6 years. There has been some use of fossil fuels, mostly on a temporary basis, but Germany's goal, as Hunter pointed out, is 100% renewable power by mid-century. And that is what they're working for, and they're working to do this. You know, they're closing both nuclear plants and fossil fuel plants at the same time. So it's a tricky thing to do. It's going to go up and down a little bit. They're still in the very early stages of doing this. This is a policy that was put into motion less than 3 years ago. They're still learning about how to do this. But, you know, one of the most telling things to me is that there was actually a day last month in Germany where 74% of the entire country's power was produced by renewables. We have utility executives here in the United States saying it's impossible to provide for renewables to provide 74% of our power. Germany just did it. This is where they're going. Is there some temporary use of fossil fuels that wasn't there 4 years ago? A tiny bit, but they're actually what is growing and what continues to grow in Germany are renewables. efficiency would grow too, except the average German family uses one quarter as much electricity as the average American family does in a year. So they're already much more energy efficient than we are. And if somebody else wants to add...
Yeah, let me add a slight bit about that. Remember, Merkel closed all of the nuclear plants all at once. And the uptake in the brown coal was particularly by the utility RWE, which had been late to the game in including renewables into its mix. Its nuclear plants were very profitable for them, so they took an immediate hit and were unprepared to do what a lot of the other German utilities had done, which is just ramp up their renewables. So they chose an option. They had a bunch of coal plants that they hadn't particularly been running. They could get access to very cheap lignite, and so they tried to preserve their profit margins by burning the cheap lignite as opposed to ramping up a capacity that they didn't have in implementing renewables. That could have easily been prevented simply by having a provision that you can't at the same time do something passingly stupid. RWE has since announced that their future is to be a distributed utility, taking from renewable sources all across the country and then spreading it back out. So they're playing catch-up, and as Michael said, this is a temporary phenomenon that's being seized on by the nuclear industry to say, oh, see, if you touch our nukes, you're going to have much worse carbon. But as Michael rightly pointed out, total German carbon emissions have been going down rapidly, and that's what we all want to have.
Okay, thank you. Going to Mo.
Hi, this is Mo Headington from Burridge, Illinois. I'm working on the premise that the only thing green about nuclear is the money. And it seems to me that the subsidies, I think we really need to focus on the subsidizing of Congress by the likes of Exelon and Entergy, whether it's, we don't have a prayer of changing Price Anderson as long as we have our paid people in Washington as well as the entities, the nuclear power industry, paying for presidential campaigns. So the fact that that likely won't change. One thing I'm looking for are some figures on the kinds of monies, because in my work with municipalities, those are the things that get people. How much money our elected officials are being paid, and to start to tar them with this. Does anyone have any handle on the figures given to Congress, President, et cetera?
Okay. Anyone have an idea for Mo about where to look for that information, or how can we get it?
Well, there's no comprehensive study of that right now, but I mean, it actually would be a good idea. And I think, you know, Michael can talk to, an effort that that we've undertaken. But I think one of the good, as a kind of an example of looking at that, is a report put out last year by Common Cause New York. They're a good government organization in New York State. And they did a detailed report looking at the money that Entergy has spent essentially trying to leverage political pressure and lobbying to keep the Indian Point nuclear power plant open. And so you can find that report on Common Cause New York's website. I think what they found is essentially that Entergy over a 10-year period spent about $50 million on lobbying and political efforts and front group organizations, to help, promote the Indian Point nuclear power plant.
You can also go to the website dirtyenergymoney.com, run by Oil Change International. They've got a tool on it where you can find out which companies are pumping dirty money into politics and which politicians are receiving it.
And this is Michael. I like your premise of the money is the only thing green about nuclear power. I think it's a good handle. Hold on to that. you know, money is a hard thing to track. One thing that we did in May, we published in May on Green World, on May 7th, we published the top 20 recipients of congressional recipients of money from the Nuclear Energy Institute over the past decade. And when I have time, we will be putting together a more comprehensive list that goes beyond those top 20, so you can, you know, we'll figure out some way to put up a chart so you can see what every congressperson received from the Nuclear Energy Institute. Although it's important to remember, of course, that the Nuclear Energy Institute is just one of a number of nuclear-oriented PACs that give money to Congress, but it's just an enormous job trying to track all of them, and at least we do have the NEI figures.
We have one last caller in the queue, and we have 1 minute before 9:30. So I'm going to go ahead and take this caller, but I do want to tell everybody you will receive a follow-up email with some of these resources in it and the link to the recording of this call. So with that, I'm opening a line to somebody in area code 308 that's a wireless caller, no name attached. Hello, are you there?
Yeah, this is Courtney, and I was wondering, so we're seeing a lot of mobilization around the EPA's new clean power plan, which is very exciting, but with companies like Exelon promoting such harmful legislation and who are certainly outspending environmental groups, what are other leverage points we can be looking for to make change and promote a carbon-free, nuclear-free agenda?
Okay, all three speakers, this is your final comment. Make it brief and pithy. Let's go for it. Michael first.
Actually, I think Tim should go first on this one.
Okay, Tim.
Well, I think, you know, beyond, you know, trying to make sure that the EPA's carbon rule stays, you know, stays clean of nuclear power subsidies, I think that, you know, we need to be monitoring what's going on and, you know, in our various states and at the federal level in terms of the kind of things that, you know, Exelon is pushing in Illinois, aside from the EPA rule, but they're going to be pushing for legislation, you know, to include nuclear in a clean energy standard, to allow nuclear to basically sell, you know, emissions credits to coal and natural gas fired power plants. I think that there's a lot of, you know, different policies that are going to be moving through the state level and through other agencies that we need to be prepared to fight on. And that's, so I think part of it is being vigilant right now. But I think, you know, to the bigger picture of, you know, of how we fight them, you know, we need to be, you know, standing, you know, with, you know, climate action activists. We need to be standing with, you know, people who are, you know, support, you know, who are in the renewable energy industry to, you know, to really, you know, to push for better policies, stronger policies to promote, you know, renewable energy, energy efficiency, climate solutions, because, you know, I think the industry, you know, I mean, you can take them at their word on this, that the advance of, you know, of sustainable energy solutions is going to be, you know, is going to make things incredibly hard for nuclear power. And I think what we can do is promote the transition to a carbon-free, nuclear-free energy future, you know, as one of the best strategies for beginning the phase out of nuclear power. I think, you know, if we can do that, if we can protect our renewable energy industry, our energy policies, in the next couple of years, we're going to start to see more nuclear plants close. Some of these uneconomical plants, you know, they're going to have the, you know, Exelon and Entergy and the other, you know, the other nuclear plant operators are going to give up the ship on some of these reactors. And I think once that starts to happen and we see that we can begin shutting down nuclear power plants and the lights don't turn off, and, you know, the energy bills don't go up, and we can do this with sustainable energy solutions. If we can do that in the next few years, then the industry's whole message here is going to lose whatever resonance it currently has.
Dr. Sylvia Earle said, "What we do in the next 10 years matters more than what humanity does in the next 10,000 years." we are in a climate crisis, and it is very important that we all stand together and use this as the opportunity to create, as Bucky Fuller said, a world that works for 100% of humanity. We have the technology, the economics is on our side. Let's do it.
Final thoughts, Michael?
Well, you know, there's the old adage, think globally, act locally. And I think over the next couple of years, in particular, that is going to be very applicable in the anti-nuclear movement, because the battleground is really going to be moving to the states. You know, we already know Congress is useless. It's going to continue to be useless, as far as I can see, for a while into the future. And in light of the EPA's carbon rules, these are not mandates. The only mandate in the rules are the targets that the states have to reach. Everything else is pretty much left up to the states as to how they're going to reach them. And different states, of course, are going to choose different ways to do that. But we really will all need to be working in our own states and organizing in our states so that we can get the best possible plans out of each state. We will continue, of course, work at the federal level to improve the rules as much as we can over the next several months. But regardless of how effective we are there, what happens in the states afterwards is what's going to matter the most. And it will really influence whether uneconomic reactors close now or are artificially subsidized and stay open longer than they should. It will influence whether any utility dares think about building any new reactors. And will also influence the levels of investment in the clean energy sources and the energy efficiency programs that we need and that our planet deserves.
And with that, I'm going to say thank you so much to our speakers, and thank you especially to everyone who gave this time this evening. And we look forward to your joining in next time. Thank you.